You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In this town, Swoozie Kurtz is probably best known as a stage actress. She's been a fixture on and off Broadway since the 1970s, and along the way she's won Tonys for her roles in Lanford Wilson's Fifth of July and John Guerra's The House of Blue Leaves. But a wider audience knows her best for her work on television, most recently as Joyce Flynn, the mother of Melissa McCarthy's character Molly in the hit sitcom Mike and Molly. Her other TV series have included Pushing Daisies and Sisters, which ran for 5 years. She's also written a book called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family that tells the story of her life as an actress and as a daughter of two remarkable parents. It's published by Penguin Press, and it brought Swoozie Kurtz to our show in April. We're re-airing that interview for you today as we begin the holiday weekend. Let's talk a little bit about your name. I guess everybody starts off with that.
Must we?
But I was assuming that you chose Swoozie as a stage name, but it's your given name?
It's my given name, yes.
And as I understand it, it actually comes from a B-17 bomber. Why would you name your kid after a B-17 bomber?
Because, you know, some people say my parents must have been drunk, really. These two adults thought this was a perfectly legitimate name for a baby. My dad was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II, and he flew this plane called the Swoos, a B-17 in World War II. And it was so important in their lives, and it was one of the few survivors of the war, that they felt, I guess my parents felt they wanted to pass this legacy down on to me, and they thought they would name me Swoosie.
Well, the plane had been named after a song that had been made popular by Kay Kaiser. It was about a bird that was half swan, half goose.
Right. So, I even heard a recording that Doris Day once did of it.
And did you feel that it was kind of a tribute song to you?
Well, no. I really feel my legacy comes from the plane. I guess I'm its namesake, or it's my namesake. I've never gotten that straight.
So your father was never shot down, was he?
No, thank God.
Despite the fact that he went on so many missions?
Yes, yes.
Was it your dad's idea that your mom should write a memoir?
It was his idea. He said, I want you to write a book, which she had never done in her life. And he went off to war, and she was pregnant with me, and we both grew inside her, me and the book, and the book was published in 1945. It's called My Rival, the Sky, and it's a beautiful book that I actually reread again when we went to war with Iraq.
But I imagine you read it originally when you were a teenager.
When I was little, then again when I was a teenager, and I was kind of condescending about it. Oh, isn't that nice that my mother got her little book published and got that out of her system? Isn't that nice? You know how kids are sort of test driving a mild disdain for anything to do with my parents. And then I read it in 2002, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I went, whoa, this could have been written yesterday afternoon, except for Skyping and texting and, you know, immediate video communication. People's feelings don't change. And when you have someone at war in harm's way, you know, back then they didn't know. My mother did not know for huge stretches of time whether my father was being held prisoner, whether he was dead, whether he was missing.
Well, he was trapped in the Philippines at some point and afraid he couldn't get home.
Yes, exactly. Right after Pearl Harbor, he was at Clark Field, and Clark Field was hit very soon after.
Did you ever get to see the Swoos?
Yes, I did, several times in my life. It was at the Smithsonian for years and years.
But it must have been tough growing up with that name. Did people assume that your name was really Swoosie when you said Swoosie?
Yes, I've had so many variations on it, and people thought it was Swedish for something, or that my parents were drunk again, I guess your baby sister can't pronounce Swoosie, you know. And I went to a bunch of schools because my dad was in the Air Force, so it was always a pain to have to explain and feel awkward, you know, at every new school.
Now you're playing an incredibly outrageous character, Joyce, on Mike and Molly, who seems in some ways to be related to Rita, the character you played in Wendy Wasserstein's play Uncommon Women and Others.
I never thought of that.
But do you see yourself at all in her?
She is kind of outrageous, like Rita. Yeah. I don't really see any similarities between me and Joyce. But I love that, because the further away...
Is that liberating?
It's so liberating, Leonard. The further away a character is for me, the more fun it is to play, because it allows me to take off my little filter, the swoosy editor in my brain, and I can say and do things with huge comfort and freedom, because it's Joyce saying them, or whoever I'm playing at the moment.
But these are things you might have thought of but would never have said.
Wouldn't have actually said, exactly.
And in fact, that's what makes the character so funny. We all understand that we have those sensors in our brains.
Yes.
But we think those thoughts.
Joyce has no filter.
Was Uncommon Women and Others a breakthrough role for you?
Completely.
Personally and professionally?
Both, yeah. Wendy Wasserstein's brilliant play came along in my life, and... I had been doing work in New York, a lot of stuff, but nothing that really put me on the map, so to speak. And that happened, and it was this landmark production that we originally did at the Eugene O'Neill Playwrights Conference in Waterford, Connecticut. And we did this, and it was this this brilliant part of Rita who just keeps saying, you know, they're all in college at Mount Holyoke, and she keeps saying, you know, when we're 25, we're going to be pretty... Mm-hmm. Amazing. Mm-hmm. And then she keeps upping. You know what? When we're 30, we're going to be so amazing. And she keeps, moving the deadline.
And you actually use that, the real word, when you received an Obie, and that caused a lot of trouble. Is that the reason the Obies stopped being broadcast for a while?
Well, it was the last time they were
You were
ever
a pioneer.
Broadcast.
Now Madonna does it. A whole bunch of different people do
I
that.
Know.
Was Rita also liberating for the same reason that Joyce is?
Rita was so liberating, especially at that time. You know, we forget, but the late 70s, you simply did not say and do the things that we say and do on TV now or in the movies. I mean, everything's out there now. This was not a time that you ever said. And for me to walk on stage and say, I've tasted my menstrual blood was... What? I kept thinking, how can I go on a stage and say this? Is this, are people going to gasp? Are they going to walk out?
Did they gasp?
They did gasp, but in a good way. And then they laughed.
Because it's slightly embarrassing. But we understand that character.
Yeah.
You give a great description of Wendy in the book, and you encourage her to do a sequel. Did you ever consider doing it?
I every time we would get together, I'd hound her about, do Uncommon Women... You know, several years on. We're all in our late 40s or 50s now. You know, at that time I was talking to her. Do them in their 50s, because I would love to see those women in a different era at that age. And she would sort of, you know, toss her curls and think about it, but it never happened.
How did you describe her in the book?
Oh, gosh. Sort of this massive pile of... sort of clothes for the laundry, a pile of clothes for the laundry with a Jufro on top. She, and I think she's been described that way by people before, and this amazing giggle that everyone talks about.
I always look forward to having her as a guest on the show.
So
were you aware that she was ill?
No, I was not. She told very few people.
You say in the book that she wanted children a lot. But you say in the book you didn't want children. Did you ever want to get married?
I didn't pursue it. You know, I didn't ever want children. I knew I didn't want children when I was like 9 or 10. I love children. But it was just not a choice, not a part of my life. And, you know, back
this
then—
This wasn't a career decision.
Well, it was partly a career decision.
Well, I mean, not when you were 10.
Well, no, you're right. Not when I was 10. Just somehow, I just knew it was not going to be a part of my life. And I think that was, is sometimes looked on very weirdly in life still. But hopefully we've come to a place where there are so many women like me who never had children by choice. And, yeah, I...
Well, people don't judge women who don't have children the same way they did 20 or 30 years
ago. It's gotten a little better.
Oh, when are you going to get married and have kids?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you heard that a few times.
Yes.
Susie Kurtz has written a memoir with the help of Joni Rogers called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. You tell a story about your relationship with Brent Spiner, another actor. How long were you together?
About 6 years.
And what was that relationship like? You never lived together.
We didn't specifically live together, but we lived two blocks apart, and we were at each other's apartments a lot. And it was, we were really compatriots, really pals in the struggle of life. And we were both actors. And
is it good for two actors to be together?
Oh, I don't think so. I try to avoid it at all costs. That was one of my pitfalls. But he was just such a great guy, so brilliant. It made me laugh so much, and that's so important to me.
Well, on the one hand, you have the advantage of being able to compare notes mm-hmm. with somebody and also tell stories that the other person will understand. On the other hand, you're both in the same business, competing for jobs, and also just wind up going all over the place. It's hard to just maintain some kind of continuity.
Yeah, I don't know how people do it. It's very tricky when you're starting out as actors like we were. You know, you're so often unemployed, and then if the other person gets a job, you're happy for them, but at the same time, it's like, oh, well, where does that leave me? And it's a very, very dicey, delicate situation.
At one point, you tell him you're going to give up a negative habit that you think is holding you back, and he says he's been planning the same thing. What did he give up?
Me. I didn't see
he
that one coming.
He considered you a negative habit?
Well, yes. He said, I want to... start doing this, stop doing that. He took them all off on his fingers, you know, do this and get rid of the negative influences in my life and start. And I said, so one of those would be me? I'm a negative? I thought I was sort of a productive, but, you know, that's what he needed to do at that moment.
And was that the end of it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You lived with your parents for the entire 5-year run of Sisters. Was that your choice or theirs?
Mine.
And your mother still lives with you.
My mom, yeah. My mom is, I was so close to both of my parents. My 98-and-a-half-year-old mother lives with me to this day, Margot. She is my confidant, my best pal, always has been, my rock. But she has dementia now and, you know, complete short-term memory loss. But she's just always been this amazing life force. And the last 7 years, I've been on this very intimate journey of caring for her, which I think a lot of people can relate to. It's been a real roller coaster ride and challenging, but I've got to tell you, Leonard, it's been the greatest gift of my life.
Well, as you describe it, your father's decline was much more difficult. At some point, you had to send him away.
My father's decline taught me so much about how to handle my mother's decline. When he started to decline, it was 1995, 96. I was doing, 15, 17-hour days on Sisters, coming home, learning my lines for the next day's shoot, and I was under a lot of stress that way. And we were living together in this tiny house of theirs, my choice, but everybody, I say in the book, like, didn't it occur to her to buy her own house? Which I eventually did, but when he started to decline, and certain things started happening around the house, and he would deny, I didn't do that. What do you, and he was very feisty and combative. And it was something I was not prepared for. My mom and I were not prepared for it at all. Who is?
You've said that dealing with your mother has taught you to learn to listen. Isn't that part of what actors have to learn?
Yeah.
I read one film historian who said that he thought what John Wayne's greatest ability as a film actor was that he looked like he was listening to the people who were talking to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listening is crucial in acting. And I think I do it in acting, but I'm not so sure in real life with my dad. And it was also about compassion. I think I have so much more compassion now at this age and this time in my life than I did when my dad was starting to decline. Mm-hmm. And it was an annoyance to me. It was, why do you have to do this? Why do you have to drive me crazy like this? And because I was still treating it as a level playing field, which it was not.
Well, he was also a very strong person in your life, and suddenly he's a dependent person.
Exactly. He was always my rock, as both my parents were.
A listener called and said that you were talked about a TV comedy that you were in with Tony Randall in the 70s about a gay man living down the hall. Was that ahead of its time?
Well, it was the first gay character ever on television. And I was very excited because I was so adamantly for this. And Tony was going to fight the good fight. And we were going to put this gay character on television.
What was the name of the show?
Love, Sydney. Mm-hmm. It was on NBC. It was 1982, 83, I think. And, well, before the show was ever aired, the affiliates started pulling out. And some advertisers started pulling out before they had even seen the show, mind you. They just heard, oh, gay character, forget it, you know. And it wasn't like blatantly gay like you see things now on television. It was very subtly written. It was just, you know, the odd reference here and there. And he was a man living alone, and he let me and my little girl move in with him and become like roommates. And it slowly got...
Sounds like another show that was a big hit some years later. Of people moving in with a gay man and being roommates.
What was that?
Well, I mean, there have been a number of shows where...
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. I know. Now it's nothing.
Will and Grace, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we... It got watered down, and Tony became kind of a happy bachelor. But it was still a very sweet show.
There's a line in the Wasserstein play where your character says something like, "It never occurred to me that someone might not want me to be so uncommon." Mm-hmm. Was that part of the problem of your time? Certainly Wendy struggled with that.
That's been a huge thing in my life. I think that all really strong women have this problem because we're really not supposed to... Oh, you know, it's changing a little, but we're not supposed to really give strong, opinionated views. And it's looked upon as being aggressive and, oh, she's a ball buster, you know, she's a bitch or whatever. And you really, it's a constant tightrope walk.
Well, we have All About Eve, for example, about the ambitious woman is the villain in that.
Right.
You say in the book that you were driven like your dad, Frank, and could have used a wife like your mother, Mark.
Oh, my God, yes, I needed a wife so badly because she kind of served as my wife for so long. She would, well, both of them would help me so much, you know, just while, when I was working incredible hours and traveling back and forth, doing two jobs at once, flying back across the country to work with Katharine Hepburn in North Carolina while I was shooting Sisters in Burbank and all these unbelievable feats I tried to accomplish and did accomplish. They would make sure I had groceries in and something to eat and think about all those things so I didn't have to.
But you were at a time, you were really establishing yourself at a time when it was okay to work in television and film at the same time. A previous generation, that was impossible. If you were a film star and you did a TV series, you kind of ruined your film career.
Oh, yeah. It was a step down. Well, I actually, though, went into television when it was not chic to go into television. When I did The Mary Show with Mary Tyler Moore and, excuse me, and Love, Sydney with Tony Randall, it was a plum job, but it was like, ooh, television series?
Well, what about that Mary series, which looks on paper like it should have been a huge success, and it wasn't.
I know.
What a cast.
What a cast. Dick Shawn, Mary Tyler Moore, David Letterman.
Letterman is an actor.
Yes, as a song and dance skit man. We were sort of a precursor of Saturday Night Live. And me and...
Michael Keaton. Wow.
Ooh.
And now the only way we can know anything about it is YouTube.
YouTube. Go on YouTube and give yourself a laugh.
So what happened? Why do you think that didn't make it?
It was a variety show, mm-hmm. a 60-minute variety show.
Yeah, but Carol Burnett was a huge star
right.
with a variety show.
Yeah. It was just a mismatch somehow of material with Mary, with... I don't know. They only aired 3 episodes, and my question was, we had done 13... why they didn't pull some of our best stuff, because we had done some good stuff. You know, they could put anything they wanted in 1 hour, mix and match. And I didn't think that the stuff that they pulled, you know, I'm not running the network, but I didn't think the stuff they pulled didn't show us off to our best. But it's in a vault somewhere never to be seen.
Well, it's always curious what the executives think in relation to what the public thinks.
Yes,
well, what we know in hindsight. When you were beginning your theater career in New York City, you played characters that were much younger than you, didn't you? Was that also liberating? You played all three girls in The Effect of Gamma Rays on Man in the Moon Marigolds.
When I was probably 30, 33, I played Muriel in Ah Wilderness, who's 15, when I was, 30. And I continued to do that for quite a
playing
while.
Playing teenagers or young 20s.
Yes, much, much younger than I had any right to do. I'm still cast younger, way younger than my actual god-awful years. We don't deal with that number.
Is that liberating as well, or is that just odd, of trying to remember what you were like when you were much younger? I'm not sure I'm ready to play myself as a teen.
Well, but it wouldn't be playing myself. You know, it's playing a character. That's incredibly liberating because it's not being childish, it's being childlike. And I think I have a quality of childlikeness that is very freeing for me.
Well, you've had all sorts of challenges. Your character Lillian Pushing Daisies had one eye.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, my dad, I tell in the book about my dad, who was this amazing pilot and high platform diver. And
he was in the Berlin Olympics?
He was.
The Hitler Olympics.
Mm-hmm. He saw Hitler turn his back on Jesse Owens, and he was there for the opening day terrifying ceremonies that just left the ground and everybody there shaking. But he had an operation in New York for a little TIA that he'd had, a slight stroke of. You know, he just needed his carotid artery cleaned out. And he had this operation in New York here. And the surgeon botched it. And my dad's optic nerve was severed. And he lost the sight in one eye. So for him, he was in denial about it a long time. And when he finally realized that he literally couldn't see out of one eye, I mean, it changed his life from that point
Especially
on.
Especially a pilot who relied so much
pilot,
on having perfect eyesight.
Exactly, the accuracy. And the reason I mention it, it's because when I came to play Lily in Pushing Daisies with the eye patch, it wasn't just a joke to me. I finally had my father's point of view, literally and metaphorically. I realized what life was like for him.
Isn't it true that you originally hoped to play Bunny in The House of Blue Leaves and wound up instead as Bananas?
Yes. Well, they sent it to me to read, and I read it, and I, of course, thought, oh, well, Bunny, she gets all the laughs. That's the more glittery, you know, show-stealing part, and I don't understand this other Bananas who's sort of off to the corner in her bathrobe, and she said these weird things like, my fingernails are all different lengths. I can't leave the house. I just didn't get it.
Jerry Zaks help at all, the director?
Oh, Jerry Zaks, brilliant. Did he help? My God, I've still got his notes. I use them on every project I do.
But you won a Tony with that role.
Yes.
And you were up against Starkey Channing, who played Bunny.
I know, and she was brilliant. I mean, it's how can you choose who's better? You can't. It's nobody's better in those categories. I just wish they would give everybody a prize for excellence.
But this book is as much about successes as about disappointments.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes getting a role that you wish had been larger, like the role you played in Slapshot with Paul Newman, other things like Scandal, which didn't work out.
Yes.
Is that just normal for any actor?
I think so. George Clooney once told me that he did a million pilots, TV pilots that didn't work out. And he said he did one, they did the table read of it, and everybody came up to him and said, oh my God, you're magic in a bottle. It's just incredible. And the next day he was fired. He was replaced. So, it's the constant ups and downs and just taking that ride and trying to stay on an even keel.
How did you wind up becoming an actor? You wanted to be a ballerina, didn't you?
Yeah, I first wanted to be a ballerina when I was little, and I trained in ballet, and I loved it. And
well, your father was athletic.
Yes, and he really taught me line and alignment and, you know, all the physical stuff that I worshipped him for. And I think it segued when I was in high school. I did a scene in acting class, and it was like Eureka in the bathtub. I made a connection with an audience that I couldn't make as myself in real life with people. And it was startling, and it was like a spark of electricity. And
when you hear an audience react, whether it's a gasp or a laugh.
Exactly.
There's something magical.
Yes. Whether you make someone cry, make them laugh, move them in some way, there's that connection. It's like zzz, it's like an electrical, it's like taking the heroin and having it go through your body, and it's like a drug, and you have to have it again.
So what happens when you're in a sitcom? And there's a difference between the ones that are performed for a live audience and the other ones that have laugh tracks. When you're working with a laugh track, you have no idea whether anybody's going to respond. Although when you watch it on television, they're roaring uproariously.
Oh, I know. I remember one moment while we were doing Love, Sydney with Tony Randall. I was doing it, and it was the first show, and I wasn't used to sitcom. And we came off stage after one scene, and I said, "Damn it, I did not do that right. I didn't get a laugh on that line, Tony." And he said, "You will." And I was outraged as a someone from the theater.
Someone's just going to push a button.
You cannot. You have to earn a laugh. You can't just give me a laugh.
Your first paid role was on the Dinah Reed Show?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I was starting near the top.
High school. Yeah.
Well, now you have a hit television show. Any sense of how long this thing is going to run?
We just finished our fourth season and got picked up for our fifth season coming up.
And now you're a published author?
Yes. I can't
believe it. Like your mother?
The book comes out today. It's like an opening night for me today.
It's called Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family, published by Perigee. Is it Perigee or Perigee?
Perigee.
Perigee, which is part of the Penguin Group.
Penguin Group, right.
And with a blurb from one of my favorite people in the world, Carol Burnett.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much for having me, Leonard.